Even some of the Latino men, cooks and security guards and busboys, waved signs that said, "Women for Hillary." When a Spanish-speaking precinct captain instructed the crowd to sit on La Izquierda if they were for Bernie and La Derecha if they were for Hillary, the Hillary side of the room erupted, thrusting their arms in the air, chanting, "Hillary! Hillary!" This relegated to a sad little corner of the left side of the Milano One ballroom a handful of white men, some of whom appeared to be pit bosses, the buttons on their black vests temporarily undone, and a dozen or so younger Latino men who held Bernie signs with the silhouette of his white hair and the words, "Educación gratis." The caucus had the feel of a frenzied, romantic, proletariat coup unfolding in a mid-sized casino ballroom instead of the Plaza de Armas of some Latin American capital, and lasted no more than 5 minutes. Similar pro-Hillary caucuses played out at casinos across the strip. But that wasn't the whole story. The culinary workers' unions, rank and file, who lined up at the Wynn and Harrah's and Rio and New York, New York, and handed the caucuses to Hillary, had only been there at all because their bosses had given them their blessings and boxed lunches. And that had only happened because the Democratic establishment made sure that it would. The man known as Prince Harry picked up the phone and called this city's ruling class. He told the union bosses and hotel owners in so many words, "Nice casino you've got there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it." When it was all over, Clark County, which includes Las Vegas and 72% of the state's population, made Hillary the winner by more than 5 points. She'd regained the momentum and headed into South Carolina on an entirely different trajectory than just hours earlier. We started to write Bernie's obituary. Hillary devoted her win to hotel and casino workers who never wavered, and tens of thousands of men and women with kids to raise, bills to pay, and dreams that won't die. She used plural pronouns like we and us more than usual, avoiding I. "I'm on my way to Texas. Bill is on his way to Colorado. The fight goes on. The future is within our grasp." On deadline, and with no office center in sight, I took the escalators 2 flights down to the casino, where I spotted an empty electrical outlet next to a Sex and the City-themed slot machine, and sat down to charge my laptop. A security guard came by and told me I couldn't sit there unless I was gambling, so I loaded a few quarters and dollar bills into the slot machine as I typed, wondering if I could submit the expenses to our draconian newsroom administrator. Were they entertainment or water snacks and incidentals? I walked away with $45 when Mr. Big aligned with 2 pairs of Carrie's Manolo Blahniks. A waitress dropped off a bottle of Caesar's branded water, and I broke open the plastic cap and took a sip. I looked at my phone and saw the news that Jeb had dropped out. Jen said it was the campaign's best day yet. Backstage, Hillary cried. On the way to the Elite Travel private terminal of the McCarran International Airport, the travelers and staff picked up 6 packs of Peroni, and everyone landed in Houston for a late-night rally feeling happy drunk. Chapter 31, The Plane Situation. March 2016. The Friday morning before the South Carolina primary, Hillary made an unannounced stop at the Saffron Cafe and Bakery in Charleston. Still high from Vegas, she floated over to a table full of Southern frat boys, a groom and his 10 groomsmen, each more clean-cut than the next. "That looks like a really good Bloody Mary," Hillary said, eyeing their cocktails at approximately 10:44 a.m. Barb Kinney, the campaign photographer, instructed the dudes to kneel down on one knee as if they were proposing and positioned Hillary at the center. "I love having men at my feet," Hillary said. The next day, she beat Bernie by 47 points in South Carolina. Saturday, February 27th, Charleston, South Carolina, en route, Birmingham, Alabama. Birmingham, Alabama, en route, Columbia, South Carolina. Ron, remaining overnight, Columbia, South Carolina. Sunday, February 28th, Columbia, South Carolina, en route, Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis, Tennessee, en route, Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville, Tennessee, en route, Pine Bluffs, Arkansas. Ron, Pine Bluffs, Arkansas. Monday, February 29th, Pine Bluffs, Arkansas, en route Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield, Massachusetts, en route Boston. Boston, en route Norfolk, Virginia. Ron, Norfolk, Virginia. Tuesday, March 1st, Norfolk, Virginia, en route IAD. IAD en route Miami, Florida. Ron, Miami, Florida, or commercial to your final destination. With Trump surging, Republicans delivering bleary-eyed concession speeches almost daily, and Bernie appearing to be the Walking Dead, my editors had virtually forgotten I, or Hillary, existed as Super Tuesday approached. My colleagues on the investigative team had a gripping deep dive into Hillary's legacy in Libya. The Times, afraid the story could affect the race, decided not to publish it until after the polls closed in South Carolina. I rolled my eyes when I heard this. I'd spent months talking to voters in black churches and cafes and union halls, and the last thing on their minds was Hillary's use of smart power in the ouster of Gaddafi. I received a late-night email from a very senior editor who'd never commented on my coverage before. He asked me what the campaign's reaction to the Libya story was. "I haven't heard anything," I replied. "They're all pretty elated after last night's win." I didn't know why the email upset me so much. Yes, I was hurt. I was in the midst of covering an evening rally in Pine Bluffs, Arkansas, a time-worn, predominantly black town on the Delta lowlands with a poverty rate more than twice the national average. I'd been on the road for weeks, had just logged another 20-hour day, and wanted very senior editor to acknowledge my work. The Oscars were happening during the rally, and we snuck peeks at Twitter in between transcribing Hillary's comments about empowerment zones and the New Markets Tax Credit and statistics from the Clinton years. During Bill's terms, the median African-American family income went up 33%. New York and the Times newsroom existed on a planet as foreign to Pine Bluff as the red carpet at the Dolby Theater, one where people had an entirely different perspective on the election than in the places I visited. They had different concerns from the people Hillary spent her days talking to, different expectations from the families who stuck Trump yard signs into their freshly mowed grass. I couldn't answer very senior editor's question even if I'd wanted to. Traveling with the campaign meant I knew far less about what was happening inside the campaign than if I'd been back in New York working the phones or meeting sources in Brooklyn. It had been 84 days since Hillary held a press conference. We all bitched incessantly that we needed more access, but Hillary didn't see any reason to talk to us. With everything going her way post-Vegas, her media strategy could continue to consist of a couple of sit-downs with the celebrity talk show host Amanda Decadenay and Glozell Green, the YouTube comedian with the silvery emerald lips. Compared to the Trump press corps, whom he publicly humiliated and who had to dodge loogies and abuse from enraged everydays, at least one of whom wore a T-shirt that said "Rope, Tree, Journalist, Some Assembly Required." The Hillary press was coddled. We didn't need bodyguards to escort us into her rallies, and while being ignored was unpleasant, it was nothing compared to a candidate who threatened to blow up the First Amendment. Still, I would have endured being called third rate at a rally in Youngstown if it meant Hillary gave us as many interviews as Trump gave reporters. He put on a big show of hating us, but he'd get on the phone no problem. In a way, Trump's mistreatment of the media had done Hillary a favor by freeing her of the decorum of a traditional campaign. But it also meant the reporters who spent their days trying to cover and explain Hillary to the American public never got to bridge, as one reporter who traveled with the First Lady in the 1990s put it, the disconnect between the kind of person you could convey or are in private and amongst us on these trips, so much sense of humor, very warm and engaging in what we see on television or in the news. How could we communicate Hillary's funny, wicked, and wacky side to voters if we never saw it for ourselves? Had this been any other election year, the candidate and top aides would be flying on the same plane as the traveling press, as had been the practice in every modern presidential campaign since the dawn of mass air travel. Instead, Brooklyn organized a separate press charter for the travelers and billed our news outlets, while Hillary and her staff flew on their own private plane. In 2008, The Close Quarters of Hill Force One and later The Change We Can Believe In Express led to the only real interactions I had with Hillary and Obama. I remember Hillary taking over the intercom to welcome us on the rickety 737. "Welcome aboard the maiden flight of Hill Force One. My name is Hillary, and I'm so pleased to have most of you on board," she said. "FAA regulations prohibit the use of any cell phones, Blackberries, or wireless devices that may be used to transmit a negative story about me." We developed such solidarity on the shared plane that the press decorated our quarters with a Hillary pantsuit schedule, an oversized wall calendar with a rotating cast of Hillary in Forsythia yellow, Monday, turquoise blue, Tuesday, fiesta pink, Wednesday, sunset orange, Thursday, showstopper red, Friday. The night of the Ohio and Texas primaries, the campaign plane hit gale force winds, and I saw lightning flash against the wingtips. Tina Brown looked as if she was about to puke. I grasped hands with one of the New York tabloid reporters and, thinking we'd die, actually said, "Now we'll never know if she won Ohio." Peter Nicholas, who was with the Los Angeles Times then, loves to tell the story of the time Hillary walked in on me taking a piss. "She opens the door and there's Amy with her pants around her ankles," he said to a small crowd of senior campaign aides and TV correspondents during the spaghetti dinner at Podesta's house. Peter always told the story with his usual theatrical peculiarity and amplified fidgets and grins, glances at me, at the carpet, me, the carpet. I remember the moment exactly when the accordion door with a broken lock began to split in its middle and fold into the campaign plane's back lavatory. The smell of the blue ammonium swirling in the bowl, a sunset orange pant leg forcing its way in. I knew that hue didn't belong to the other reporters on the plane. An instant later, it hit me. That was Thursday's pantsuit. Hillary Clinton needs to pee. I'd already pulled my jeans up to the fleshy part of my sit bones when we made eye contact. Senator, I'm so sorry. I guess the lock isn't working and..." I started. Her facial features widened, and before she could say anything, a Secret Service agent inserted his tree trunk of a torso between us, and Hillary backed up like Ginger Rogers sashaying into a Rent-A-Jet service area. I rushed back to my seat with my fly still down. Peter, who sat in the same row as me in the designated Major Daly seat of the plane, noticed the commotion and asked in his loudest outdoor voice, "Did Hillary just walk in on you urinating?" In April, when it was obvious Hillary wouldn't be the nominee, I switched over to covering Obama and assumed a seat on the Change We Can Believe In Express. 2 months before the 08 general election, Bobby surprised me and proposed. He had a sunburned nose and hair so dark it blended in with the night sky. He got down on one knee at the front of the bow on a sailboat in the Sea of Cortez and pulled the navy blue velvet box out of the pocket of his cargo shorts, where he'd hid the ring when we passed through immigration in Mexico a couple of days earlier. "You know the way I've always liked you," Bobby said, over the yelps of sea lions and the waves brushing against the starboard. The air smelled of salt water and the green enchiladas cooking in the kitchen below. I'd never seen myself as somebody's wife, but Bobby understood me better than anyone. He'd put up with long distance in Japan. When I left him again to meet up with Hillary in 07, he'd rented a car to meet me in New Hampshire. He'd built us bookshelves with the crafty optimism that we'd one day settle down, or not. Either way, he knew what he was getting, and he'd always liked me anyway. And I'd come to think of him as my home, a safe, warm space in the form of a hunky Irishman whose very being told me everything would be okay, and without whom I'd cease to exist. I said yes. 36 hours later, I was back on the road in Obama's traveling press in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It didn't take long before my trail friends gushed over my new radiant-cut diamond that still felt odd on my finger. Obama strolled down the aisle to the back of the plane where we were sitting. We rushed to ready our voice recorders and cameras, assuming he'd do an impromptu press avail. Instead, Obama walked right up to me and said, "Okay, let me see the rock." I stretched my hand out and he entered dad mode. That's great, so when are you quitting? He asked how long we'd been dating. Okay, 3 years is a decent stint. He said he wanted to make sure I had plenty of time to plan the wedding. After the campaign, okay, well, you know, these things take time. You gotta pick your dress. He offered to have the Secret Service and FBI do a full background check on Bobby. Happy to. The FBI can get involved. Bobby and I got married a year later in San Miguel de Allende, a colonial town in central Mexico. We had mariachis in white charro suits, a taco truck, and a donkey named Domingo that served tequila on his back. Our wedding programs included the Yates quote. Being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustained him through temporary periods of joy. At the rehearsal dinner, my parents played the video of Obama congratulating me. 8 years later, those kinds of intimacies were unimaginable. Everyone blamed Robbie for what became known as the plane situation. It wasn't true. Robbie was a miser, but flying Hillary around on her own plane didn't save money. The campaign spent $2 million on private planes between June and January when the election still hinged on only a handful of states. It cost a fortune to maintain multiple private planes for all three Clintons, not to mention the logistics involved. A refurbished Boeing 737 would have been more economical. The truth was Hillary didn't want to fly on the same plane as us. And because she was running against Trump, she didn't have to. He'd tossed all traditional decorum out the window of his 25-year-old pimped-out 757, which in classic smoke-and-mirrors fashion, he'd acquired from a now-defunct low-cost Mexican airline. Why couldn't Hillary have her own plane, too? What Hillary didn't understand, or didn't want to accept, was that Trump could lick his fingers after eating a bucket of greasy KFC on board his gold-plated 757 and maintain the aura of the working man, even if he did spend most of his business career screwing over said working man. Meanwhile, Hillary, who, regardless of what you thought of her personally, had detailed policy plans and a real determination to lift middle-class wages and put Americans back to work, couldn't shake her image as a rich lady from Westchester. She flew on private planes and wore tunics that everydays couldn't buy off the rack at Macy's. Hillary's girlfriends finally forced her to stop saying, "You shouldn't have to be the granddaughter of a president or a secretary of state to receive all the support and advantages that will one day lead to a good job and a successful life." Hillary loved the line, but it only reminded voters that she was one half of a political dynasty. At one event when Hillary did the granddaughter line, 80% of a child's brain is formed before the age of three. A longtime aide leaned over and whispered to me, "I guess I was brain dead by age four." But nothing made Hillary seem like more of a monarch than her insistence that she be cocooned in the clouds at 36,000 feet, a safe distance from the press and the everydays, surrounded only by her royal court, security, and a spread of crudité. And as the campaign's true power center, meaning Huma, Brown Loafers, Jen Palmieri, Policy Guy and Dan Schwerin, who both traveled on occasion, and assorted friends from the White House years, flew around in a pimped-out fuselage, it became easier for Hillary to ice out Brooklyn. Several senior aides thought she should share a plane with the press, the way she had in 2008 and at the State Department, arguing that the close quarters had always led to warmer coverage. "She doesn't want to do it," Huma would say. "Oh, and sorry, there's no room on the plane for you." Betty Curry, Bill Clinton's secretary in the White House, once called Hillary Land a little island unto themselves. In 2016, the little island had become a Falcon 900B heavy jet. Being ensconced in our own hulk of cherry wood and leather seats and creamed-colored carpet in the sky meant the only regular contact the travelers had with anyone outside our own ranks was the young press advance staffers tasked with keeping us on schedule. This was an almost impossible feat. We always stayed behind to pee or file our story or both. We made the bus wait if we forgot our iPhones in a bathroom stall, guilty, or got caught up in conversations with the everydays. Now that we flew to multiple states a day, falling behind schedule meant the entire press corps could spend thousands of dollars to fly to the next city or state only to miss Hillary's speech. This may come as a shock, but neither she nor Trump waited for the traveling press to start. These 20-something aspiring press aides reported to Brown loafers. I'd seen him as OG's marionette for months, but these aspiring press secretaries looked up to him as if he were the CEO of publicly traded spin. They took their main task, taking our meal orders, so seriously that I can only hope they'll one day be running the country. Obama's press luggage handler in 2008, Eric Lesser, kept spreadsheets of our bags and once chased a red negligee, falsely rumored to belong to Maureen Dowd, down the tarmac. He is now a state senator in Massachusetts. Below, please find today's meal options for both lunch and dinner. Please send me your lunch orders by 11:30 a.m. and dinner orders by 4 p.m., they'd email, usually attaching a Panera Bread menu that I'd memorized a couple of states back. We'd often mull the menu and respond with two words, hard choices. When one staffer sent us a stern reminder the night before, please reply to me with your order by 7 p.m. EST today for the following day's lunch order, we wrote back, "This is getting ridiculous," and "Too soon." They'd send around alphabetized Excel spreadsheets. Alba, Carmen, curried cauliflower and kale salad. Becker, Amanda, curried cauliflower and kale salad. Chozik, Amy, quinoa salad with chicken or turkey. Earl, Jeffrey, pistachio chicken salad sandwich on multigrain. Epstein, Jennifer, curried cauliflower and kale salad with chicken. Fraser Chompong, Hannah, chopped salad with chicken. So that by mid-March, we all knew each other's dietary preferences. NPR's Tamara Keith doesn't eat cheese. Reuters' Amanda Becker is a vegetarian. Annie Carney once threw off the entire spreadsheet system by sending in a late change to her lunch order, from salmon to the barbecue chicken plate. "Annie, please update me on the snacks you plan to have on the plane," Dan Marica emailed the group. Ruby Kramer wrote, "Really hope the barbecue was the right choice after all." After days of nonstop bitching, the guys decided to throw us Tony Goldwyn. I would have preferred if Goldwyn remained the villain from Ghost who came into my life in 1990 at the same time as the Righteous Brothers and Patrick Swayze's abs. Instead, the Hollywood actor became the embodiment of Hillary's neutered, or should I say spayed, traveling press. We were in Nashville when the actor sat with his legs spread wide across one of the bucket leather seats of our luxury bus rental and gushed about how much he loved campaigning for Hillary. He may or may not have known the guys were using him as a pawn. I stood up in my seat, my back pressed against the window to get a profile shot of Tony, his salt and pepper waves, the first few buttons of his white dress shirt left undone under a navy blue blazer. By now, everyone knew Tony as the philandering 44th president who governed, for the most part, on his ability to fill out a tailored suit and squeeze in a West Wing quickie. His role on the soapy network drama Scandal gave his ubiquitous presence on the campaign a certain meta quality that Hillary ate up for the same reasons she loved to drop that she binge-watched The Good Wife and Madam Secretary and House of Cards, all TV series that ranged from exhibiting casual Clinton undertones to small-screen propaganda. But mostly, Hillary loved Tony because he was hot and devoted to her. His jaw was shaped like a refrigerator, and he had feral gray eyes, and beneath all of that was an easiness and intellect that caused the women of Hillary's press corps to abandon whatever story we were working on and to flip our hair and ask useless questions like, "What did you think of Iowa, and how does Hillary seem today?" The guys knew us so well. Later that afternoon, I lost any shred of self-respect I had left when Tony broke the only news we'd gotten out of Hillary in weeks. She was shaking hands with college students at the Fido coffee shop in Nashville, a converted pet shop with exposed brick walls and track lighting, when Goldwyn asked what she thought of Trump not denouncing David Duke's support, a question she'd ignored when the travelers asked. "Oh, that's pathetic," Hillary said in Tony's direction, a response we overheard and all used in our stories. The CNN cryon flashed, "Hillary calls Trump on KKK leader pathetic." That's when Huma handed Hillary a latte in a to-go cup, made with locally grown Tennessee honey, cinnamon, milk, and espresso, and said to her boss, "They're amazing. They're making a ton of them for us to take." The travelers watched this, our mouths watering, as Hillary and Huma headed out a back door. Chapter 32, The Gaff Tour. March 2016. The less I interacted with Hillary, the greater her imperial hold on my brain became. I used to get my hair blown out straight so I could go a week, 9 days if I didn't sweat, on the road without washing it. But in early March, I quit doing this, afraid Hillary wouldn't recognize me if she looked out the press scrum, decided to acknowledge us, and didn't see my usual mane of brown curls. I started to have nightly Hillary dreams. We usually gossiped like old girlfriends. We were trying on clothes in adjacent dressing rooms at a Zara, or maybe it was a Mango, but it was definitely in Barcelona. I couldn't button a size 6 pair of pants, and Hillary told me I must be pregnant. I said it was campaign weight, and we argued like that from underneath the dressing room stall for what felt like hours. I'd wake up and relay these dreams to Bobby until even he started to question my sanity. "Fucking hell with the Hillary dreams," he said, rolling onto his side away from me one Sunday morning. Hillary won 8 of the 13 contests on Super Tuesday. We'd enter the "Bernie who?" phase of the primary when she'd refer only vaguely to my esteemed opponent. Hillary had been so pumped after South Carolina that she'd even shown flashes of St. Hillary preaching about the country's need for more love and kindness. At a rally in Nashville, when she heard a chant of, "We love you, Hillary," she stopped and said, "You know, I'm all about love and kindness, so I appreciate that." Her reworked stump speech focused almost entirely on denouncing Trump. The most controversial woman in American politics for the past couple decades had finally found her raison d'etre, the great unifier. "What a super Tuesday," Hillary said at her victory rally at the Ice Palace Film Studios in Miami. "We know we've got work to do, but that work is not to make America great again. America's never stopped being great. We have to make America whole. We have to fill in what's been hollowed out." Trump was no longer the Pied Piper. He was the unacceptable alternative who would motivate Democrats and drive independents, moderate Republicans, the half the country who disliked and distrusted Hillary, to her side. I have to admit, I liked the retooled message. Hillary still had no clear rationale for why she wanted to be president, but reminding voters she wasn't Trump seemed like a better reason than building ladders of opportunity. But even as Hillary declared in Miami that trying to divide America between us and them is wrong and we're not going to let it work, back in Brooklyn, Robbie et al. Were feverishly slicing and dicing the nation's demographics right down to zip codes and church attendance and TV viewing habits. There were church-going black women who loved Hillary. "She was loyal to her husband and she'll be loyal to us," one woman at the Mount Zion Fellowship Church in Cleveland told me. The so-called Southern firewall was working. Hillary ran up the score with black voters in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, and Virginia, and Latinos in Texas. Bernie won whites in Oklahoma, Vermont, Colorado, and Minnesota. Brooklyn started to worry black voters might feel exploited. After Super Tuesday, Brooklyn raced to install a black campaign vice chair or senior advisor to send the message that Hillary puts her actions where her mouth is and actually does appreciate the black vote. Enter Mignon Moore, a powerhouse and Hillary Land alum. Like most of Hillary's female friends, many of whom were women of color, Mignon was equal parts terrifying and a lot of fun. I'd heard she defended me early on after the guys portrayed me as a Lucifer in Lululemon. She said to Hillary, "Are you kidding me? She's just a young woman trying to do her job." Mignon set up her office on the 10th floor of the Brooklyn headquarters, near Podesta, Mook, Jen, and Policy Guy. But for many young black voters, the stench of exploitation remained. Even months later, when Obama said he'd consider it a personal insult if black voters didn't support Hillary, absolutely hate this framing of the necessity of voting for Democrats that places all the blame on marginalized and young folks, Van R. Newkirk II, a writer for The Atlantic, tweeted. Hillary was baffled when everyone said she'd been pandering to black voters when she told Power 105.1's The Breakfast Club that she carries hot sauce in her bag. She'd always traveled with hot peppers and hot sauce and didn't know the lyrics to Beyoncé's Lemonade anyway. "Who was I pandering to? The hot sauce lobby?" she'd ask people. Hillary had hardly left the stage at the Miami Ice Palace when Robbie sent out a memo essentially predicting her defeat in Michigan. He noted that Bernie had spent $3 million on TV ads in the state and is competing very aggressively in Michigan. Robbie and his delegate calculator didn't see the point of investing much there. The math didn't make sense. Even if Senator Sanders were able to eke out a victory there, we would still net more delegates in Mississippi, which holds its election on the same night. Who needs Michigan when you've got Mississippi? I figured Robbie was downplaying expectations. The campaign's internal polling had Hillary at least 5 points ahead in Michigan. I was so certain she'd win that the night of the primary, I decided to skip her rally in Cleveland. I wasn't writing the main news story, and getting there would have involved a 4-hour drive from Detroit and an early morning flight to Miami. But those were excuses. The truth was, I wanted to see Bobby and sleep in my own bed. I could live stream the speech. But as the results trickled in, my editors panicked. "You get any sense of the mood over there?" Carolyn emailed. I didn't lie, but I also didn't volunteer that I was on the Lower East Side. Mama wouldn't be happy if she knew I was at home watching Wolf Blitzer while slurping down tiny buns in my pajamas. "It's not good," I emailed. "She has got to kill this narrative that she is a regional candidate who only wins in the South." Both of these statements were technically true. The mood in our living room that night was definitely not good, and Hillary had to prove she could win whites in the Midwest. Aside from worrying that I'd let Carolyn down, my main thought when CNN called the contest for her esteemed opponent was, "Fuck! This motherfucking primary is never going to fucking end!" I stomped around the apartment making calls to sources about why she lost and what it means. I booked my flight to Miami in the morning and threw my roller bag open on the bed and stuffed it with layers to get me through several climates while reciting something like, "Fucking motherfucking Michigan, fuck, fuck." By midnight, Bobby wished he were watching CNN's Magic Map all by himself. In her Cleveland speech, Hillary didn't mention losing Michigan or winning Mississippi, but for the first time, she showed the subtlest of public signs of what she'd been saying privately for months. Her lifelong belief that we're all in this together just didn't fit with the off-with-their-heads election year. For 11 months, I'd heard Hillary say, "I want to be the president for the struggling, the striving, and the successful." But that night, she said, "I don't want to be the president for those who are already successful. They don't need me. I want to be the president for the struggling and the striving." Hillary was on a rampage. Several Brooklyn sources told me she'd been exasperated by my Michigan postmortem and the Times coverage as she was Bernie Sanders, and that was saying something. Hillary may have even preferred stories about her emails or her psychological state to stories about her evolving message. See, spontaneity is embargoed until 4 p.m. She thought I'd blown up a slight variation on her standard line into the front page above the fold story that said she'd been stung by the bad showing and was already recalibrating her message, even altering her standard line before the Michigan race had been called. I wrote that the state's white voters had been scarred by the free trade deals like NAFTA that Bill Clinton signed into law. I know this irked her, but honestly, I couldn't believe Hillary still hadn't figured out what to say about NAFTA. During the 2008 primary, she bashed her husband's signature trade deal in Ohio. Then we'd fly to South Texas, where the economy was going gangbusters, thanks partly to NAFTA, and she'd praise its impact. Obama summed it up in 2008. The fact is, she was saying great things about NAFTA until she was running for president. Now Bernie talked nonstop about her paid speeches to Wall Street. "I kind of think if you're going to be paid $225,000 for a speech, it must be a fantastic speech, a brilliant speech which you would want to share with the American people," and her support for the disastrous trade agreements written by corporate America. The night after Michigan, at the next Democratic debate in Miami, Joel Benenson insisted Rust Belt voters didn't give a shit about NAFTA. They'd crunched the data and said trade didn't motivate the suburban women and minorities of the vaunted Hillary coalition. "It's just not an issue that we're seeing," he said. Jin Palmieri shook her head at me outside in the swampy South Florida air. "NAFTA, Amy? Really?" The next morning, after the travelers flew from Miami to Tampa only to miss most of Hillary's speech, I complained via email. "We invest a lot of time and resources into traveling and expect at the very, very least to be at the events." Brown Loafers replied, "Yes, I wouldn't want her message being mischaracterized." And, "I'm sorry you guys are delayed, but I have sympathy for just about everyone on the road but you today." Thursday, March 10th. Miami, Florida, en route Tampa, Florida. Tampa, Florida, en route Durham, North Carolina. Durham, North Carolina, en route Vernon Hills, Illinois. Ron, Chicago, Illinois. Friday, March 11th. Press should make their own way to St. Louis, Missouri, to resume traveling with us the morning of Saturday, March 12th. Saturday, March 12th, press will meet at first location in St. Louis, Missouri, exact timing and location, TBD, but will be sent to you as soon as possible. St. Louis, Missouri, en route Cleveland, Ohio. Ron, Cleveland, Ohio. To make matters worse, I couldn't stop itching. I was convinced I'd picked up scabies at a La Quinta Inn at the Miami airport, where a working girl in a tiny miniskirt had paid cash for her room before I approached the front desk to inquire about our corporate Amex rate. I couldn't sleep, certain there was something alive and burrowing under my skin. I couldn't get out of the bubble to see a doctor until a couple of days later when the campaign got to Chicago and Hillary took a day off to attend Nancy Reagan's funeral in Simi Valley, California. For 2 days, I tried to type with one hand so I could scratch with the other. My arms and legs were dry and dotted with puffy red marks. "Not scabies," the doctor said as he scribbled on a prescription pad. He said the agonizing itch was an allergic reaction to cheap hotel detergent and gave me a prescription for an antihistamine and an ointment that made my suitcase smell like sulfur. I wasn't convinced. "Are you sure? I texted my friend Barry, who got scabies from the towels at our boot camp, and he said it looks like scabies." He was losing his patience. "Mites are parasites. They would have nested and bred between your fingers. There's nothing there." "Oh, thank God, thank God, thank God. That seemed disgusting and awful, and I definitely wasn't going to have time to fumigate my clothes before Tuesday." I'd hardly jumped off the exam table when I looked at Twitter and saw Hillary had a momentary brain fart. In an interview with Andrea Mitchell, she praised Nancy Reagan's low-key advocacy on HIV/AIDS. She said the First Lady, who notoriously ignored HIV/AIDS even as thousands of gay men died, had started a national conversation when before nobody would talk about it. I'm away from my laptop for 10 minutes, and she had to piss off the gays. Hillary so rarely misspoke that every gaffe, if left hanging there, could stretch out for months, years, hell, her whole career. See cookies, tease. But the pressure to be perfect started to take on a whole new meaning when it looked like she'd be running against Trump. "He can say whatever the fuck he wants, but she's exhausted and tried to think of something nice to say about a dead lady?" Jen asked me that night. Fair question. I didn't have an answer. I still don't. That night, when Trump canceled his Chicago rally amid violent protests, I heard from Trump sources who said Brooklyn had staged the unrest to draw attention away from the Nancy Reagan AIDS gaffe, again giving the Clinton campaign way too much credit. The gaffe tour continued. 2 days later, Hillary said during a CNN town hall in Columbus that her clean energy plan would put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. She'd already hemorrhaged white working-class voters to the point that no one remembered that those had been her people in 2008. And now this. Later that week, she shook hands on the rope line in Charlotte, North Carolina, and over the hum of fight song, a voice yelled out, "Secretary Clinton, why did you say you were going to destroy coal jobs?" Trump loved contrasting Hillary's comment with his own vague promise to put our steelworkers and our miners back to work. His campaign released a video of his mushrooming crowds of mostly white men waving "Trump digs coal" signs. On the third day, she apologized. Asked if Hillary would talk to the press, one of the guys said, "No, it's a self-immolation day." Hillary later did what I called an Appalachian apology tour, a two-day bus tour through coal country during which an out-of-work coal worker, Bo Copley, confronted her during a roundtable discussion at a health center in Bloody Mingo County, West Virginia. "How could you say you're going to put a lot of coal miners out of jobs and then come in here and tell us you're going to be our friend?" Copley said. "I understand the anger, and I understand the fear, and I understand the disappointment that is being expressed. How could it not be, given what's going on here?" Hillary told Bo. "Because of the misstatement that I made, which I apologize for when I saw how it was being used, I know that my chances in Appalachia are pretty difficult, to be honest." I sat on the floor feet away and studied Hillary. She didn't win over Copley, a Republican who planned to vote Trump. But it had been one of her best moments. She'd shown empathy and that she had real plans to create good-paying, clean energy jobs. Mostly, though, Hillary had shown up. That same month, we were outside Tacoma, Washington. Tribal leaders bestowed on Hillary the Lushootseed Indian name, meaning strong woman, and wrapped a ceremonial Pendleton blanket over her emerald green leather blazer, the one with the three-quarter sleeves and the fat buttons. The travelers, the 10 or so of us who stayed on to cover the Washington State caucuses, stood outside as a light mist fell on the Puyallup Indian Reservation. Brown loafers broke down the Hillary gaffe matrix. Number one, you get something wrong. Example, Hillary said in 2008 that as First Lady she'd arrived in Bosnia under sniper fire. In reality, she'd been surrounded by children, Sheryl Crow and Sinbad, who told the Post that the scariest part of the trip had been deciding where to eat. Number two, you say something inartfully. Example, also in 2008, Hillary defended her choice to remain in the primary even though Obama appeared to be the nominee by saying, "We all remember Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California." Or number three, you say something that you mean but you didn't intend to say. Example, months later, Hillary calling half of Trump's supporters a basket of deplorables would fit nicely into category three. The campaign argued Trump and the GOP had taken Hillary's coal comments so wildly out of context that it didn't even pass as a gaffe. She was talking about creating clean energy jobs. It was ridiculous, Brown loafers said. Florida, win. North Carolina, win. Ohio, win. Illinois, win. Missouri, win. It was Tuesday, March 15th, and Hillary, even with her gaffes, had cleaned the fuck up. For her victory speech, she chose West Palm Beach, down the road from where Trump delivered his own victory speech at Mar-a-Lago. "This is another Super Tuesday," she said. Hillary had this incongruous urge to rhyme whenever she wanted to drive home a serious point. In her stump speech, it was, "No bank is too big to fail, and no executive is too powerful to jail." And, "Inversion? It's more like a perversion." Was the country ready for a president who sounded like Dr. Seuss? When we hear a candidate for president call for rounding up 12 million immigrants, banning all Muslims from entering the United States, when he embraces torture, that doesn't make him strong. It makes him wrong, Hillary said in her West Palm Beach victory speech. She called on every American to fight the GOP frontrunner's bluster and bigotry. In a campaign that had lacked electricity, that night in West Palm Beach was electric. Even Brooklyn thought she'd lose Ohio and Missouri, especially after the coal gaffe, or non-gaffe, depending on who you asked. But she'd shown that scrappy underdog side Bill always talked about. On the Saturday night before St. Patrick's Day, she made an impromptu stop at O'Donnell's Irish Pub and Grill in desolate downtown Youngstown, a former steelworker's metropolis that now has one of the highest unemployment rates in Ohio. I watched her down half a St. Patrick's Day pint of Guinness without taking a breath. "It's the best Guinness I've ever had, a Youngstown Guinness," she said, throwing down what was left of the pint onto the wooden bar. A man in a Drink Like a Champion t-shirt leaned in for a selfie. "Born in the USA," blasted from a jukebox. "She knows where the Mahoning Valley is, that's for sure," a woman yelled. Something about Hillary tossing back a cold one makes days of miserable, tedious travel all worthwhile, Peter Nicholas said. I couldn't have agreed more. In Miami, Hillary became a speedboat again. She shook hands with Black and Latino hotel workers, a move I hadn't seen her do since the Vegas casinos before the Nevada caucuses. I remembered that she did have a special connection to the working class, just not the white working class that everybody was talking about. A chubby-cheeked Afro-Cuban kitchen worker grasped one of Hillary's hands between his own and held her there for a second. He told me in Spanish, if the bridges were all destroyed, I would swim to vote for her. Rubio couldn't even beat Trump in his home state and dropped out. America's in the middle of a real political storm, a real tsunami. We should have seen this coming, little Marco said in Miami. Hillary's aides, almost all of whom descended on West Palm Beach, were elated. Rubio, who they believed to be Hillary's toughest GOP rival, vanquished by a reality TV huckster. Hillary took a couple of days off in Chappaqua to regroup and let the reality of Trump sink in. Bernie had the online donations to continue to wreak some havoc, but he was a zombie. Losing Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri meant he had lost his post-Michigan luster as the white working class whisperer. The Bernie bros didn't want to accept this reality. They flooded my inbox with the literary flair of an unemployed liberal arts major whose prime interests were Holden Caulfield, the presidential campaign, and internet porn. Patrick Healy and Amy Chozick are too busy sucking and fucking each other to spend a moment considering what Sanders is actually proposing. They provided helpful feedback on our story about the Latino vote. You're inept and biased, and if you weren't too busy licking each other's assholes and dreaming of sucking Hillary's ass, well, you already are metaphorically, you might actually have time for journalism with integrity. The emails were usually signed the same way. Go fuck yourself, and I hope it hurts. Chapter 33. Let Donald Be Donald. New York City. The early aughts. Bill Clinton was the best friend Donald Trump always hoped to have. When a sex scandal loomed over the White House, Trump defended the president, saying he was a terrific guy. His only criticism was of his choice. It was Monica, I mean, terrible choice, Trump told the Times. He'd urged the Clintons to move into one of his Trump-branded Manhattan condos when they left the White House. They opted for a five-bedroom colonial in Chappaqua instead. When a waspy Westchester golf club hesitated to accept Clinton, Donald begged him to join the Trump National Golf Club, saying Clinton is a great gentleman, a good golfer, and a wonderful guy. Both men are, in reality, mediocre golfers and cheats known for taking mulligans. Even Terry McAuliffe has pretended to enjoy 18 holes and then thrown his clubs into the trunk of his car and sworn off ever playing golf with Clinton again. When Hillary won her Senate seat, Trump sent a congratulatory note, signed in black ink and underlined twice, "Great going!" He extended invitation after invitation to host Bill and Hillary at Mar-a-Lago, but they preferred to vacation at Oscar de la Renta's place in Casa de Campo in the Dominican Republic. When I asked Trump about this unrequited friendship, he reverted to marketing mode. I don't recollect the Clintons ever staying at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, which may be the most successful private club in the United States. If they did want to stay there or stayed there, it only shows that they have good taste. Less than a year before the campaign started, Bill and Trump golfed together at Trump National. Bill casually encouraged Trump to run, thinking his candidacy would roil the Republican field. For all his political foresight, Bill spent most of the primaries oblivious that this reality TV schmo could win the Republican nomination. He insisted that Rubio would pull through even after his disastrous debate malfunction in New Hampshire. For one, Trump didn't really do politics. He was a notorious germaphobe. Trump once saw Bill speak at a post-9/11 ceremony in New York and praised the former president, saying, "He shook hands with everybody out there, and some of those people had filthy hands." When Rubio dropped out, the reality set in. Bill saw genius in Trump's economic populism and understood he was the perfect candidate for what Clinton called the Instagram election, an era when voters wanted only bite-sized solutions. Build a wall, ban the Muslims, make China pay. Hillary didn't do bite-size. We live in a Snapchat Twitter world, Clinton later unleashed on a crowd in North Carolina. It's so much easier to just discredit people and call them names. By late February, Bill went red in the face on almost daily conference calls trying to warn Brooklyn that Trump had a shrewd understanding of the angst that so many voters, his voters, the white working class whom Clinton brought back to the Democratic Party in 1992, were feeling. He wanted Hillary to speak at Notre Dame, as he and Obama and Biden had all done. But Robbie told him white Catholics weren't the demographic she needed to spend her time talking to. Robbie always listened patiently, respectfully, but he mostly saw in the former president a relic, a brilliant tactician of a bygone era. Behind his back, Robbie did a Bill impersonation, and let me tell you another thing about the white working class, waving a finger in a Clintonian motion. Mook's mafia would laugh. Any Democratic operative under 40 knew that those white voters were never coming back. The Hillary coalition was built on suburban women, minorities, and the young. Trump had insulted so many voting blocks, women, Muslims, Mexicans, the disabled, Diet Coke drinkers, etc., and provided such a veritable feast of offenses that Hillary, her top aides, and the DNC didn't think they needed to overthink the strategy. Brooklyn had organized a book of Oppo research on Rubio, Cruz, and Trump. The tome on Trump was the shortest, 157 pages, and mostly focused on his bankruptcies, his products being made in China, and some lewd comments he'd made on The Apprentice. It must be a pretty picture you dropping to your knees. They thought Trump would do the heavy lifting for them. We thought so, too. I co-wrote a story about how suburban and independent women, who will play an outsized role in deciding the fall election — this was true, they just didn't end up voting for Hillary — would be so turned off by Trump insulting Heidi Cruz's looks that they'd run into Hillary's arms. Trump hated our premise, tweeting in response, "The media is so after me on women. Wow, this is a tough business. Nobody has more respect for women than Donald Trump." When the Heidi Cruz insult fest stretched into day three, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC chairwoman, told me, "I want Donald Trump to talk every single day for the rest of this election." Hillary summed up the strategy, or lack thereof, in simpler terms: let Donald be Donald. I hadn't worked out of the New York office in months. The first thing I noticed when I got back from Miami were the balloons. In September, when I'd first put my "I'm driving long distances in Iowa" out-of-office message on and prepared for life on the trail, the Times magazine had dropped off a few extra balloons that they'd used in a photo shoot to illustrate a cover story about Trump by Mark Leibovich. The balloons were custom-made to look like Trump, with his sweep of mustardy hair across the top, a button mouth, and red power tie down the middle. They should have deflated months ago, but there was Trump's bulbous Mylar face, still buoyant and hovering over the Times politics pod. Chapter 34, Stay Just a Little Bit Longer. Madison, Wisconsin, March 2016. Saturday, March 19th, HRC has no public events scheduled. Sunday, March 20th, HRC has no public events scheduled. It went on like that for days, with a couple campaign stops in Arizona and California mixed in. Hillary figured she'd focus on fundraising and ride out the remainder of the late March and early April primary contests. Washington, Wisconsin, Alaska, Idaho, Wyoming, the white voters in those states were feeling the burn anyway. She didn't need them to win the nomination. Wisconsin, the only state with any real electoral value, hadn't voted for a Republican since 1984 when Ronald Reagan swept 49 states. The state's conservative talk show host, Charlie Sykes, called Trump a whiny, thin-skinned bully. Monday, March 28th, HRC will attend a fundraising event in Chicago, Illinois, and then will deliver remarks on the Supreme Court in Madison, Wisconsin, and hold an organizing event in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tuesday, March 29th, HRC will be campaigning in Milwaukee, La Crosse, and Green Bay, Wisconsin. In keeping with her "Let Donald be Donald" mantra, Hillary decided to talk to the travelers. On a stop at the Pearl Street Brewery, a chic industrial space in La Crosse, Wisconsin, with silver kegs, exposed pipes, and a foosball table, Hillary expressed her solidarity with the Breitbart News reporter Michelle Fields, who brought a battery charge against Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. "I think that the reporter who brought the charge deserves a lot of credit for following through on the way she was physically handled at an event. And I think the charges being brought today certainly suggest that the authorities thought her story was credible," Hillary said. Asked if she'd fire her own campaign manager if he'd done something like that, a scenario that seemed unlikely given Robbie's admirable self-restraint, Hillary demurred. "I'm not going to comment on this particular case." But she said that Trump's negative and really mean-spirited language and actions were to blame. "He is like a political arsonist. He has set some fires and then people have acted in ways that I think are deplorable." Deplorable. Adjective. Deserving strong condemnation. Completely unacceptable. Shockingly bad in quality. The New Oxford American Dictionary. Then Hillary held a pint under the tap and poured herself a downtown nut brown ale. "I bet these reporters would like it," she said, and took a long swig. "Cheers, it's good." The travel schedule was so blissfully light that I'd flown into Madison the previous morning and had time to squeeze in a spin class just off the University of Wisconsin campus before covering Hillary's speech about the Supreme Court opening left by Justice Antonin Scalia's death. She said that in Trump, Republicans got the hate-spewing candidate they deserved. When you have a party dead set on demonizing the president, you may just end up with a candidate who says the president never legally was the president at all. After that, Hillary went shopping. At a stop at the Anthology Boutique, she browsed through beaded necklaces, magnets with vintage maps of Wisconsin, and other assorted tchotchkes. "Hello, everybody. How are you?" she said to the travelers as we squatted in the back of the kitsch-filled store. "We're determined to do some shopping. We've had a retail drought. I'm kind of looking, truly." She settled on a red beaded necklace and a button that read, "Keep calm and vote Hillary." She called out to brown loafers for some cash. As she headed for the door, Hillary looked back at the 10 or so of us and said, "I love being in Wisconsin. I look forward to being here, meeting with people. We're just going to work hard." Wednesday, March 30th. HRC will be campaigning and attending fundraising events in New York City. Thursday, March 31st, HRC will be likely campaigning in New York and attending fundraising events in Massachusetts. Friday, April 1st, HRC will be attending a fundraising event in New Jersey. Saturday, April 2nd, HRC has no events scheduled at this time. Sunday, April 3rd, HRC has no events scheduled at this time. That was Hillary's last trip to Wisconsin. Chapter 35. The Kids Are All Right. New York City, April 2016. To say I didn't anticipate that Bernie Sanders would continue to be a pain in Hillary's ass until the very last contest in June, or that he'd ignite a burgeoning insurgency and roil the Democratic Party for years to come, would be putting it mildly. I initially brushed Bernie off with such casual nonchalance, such ill-informed elite media snobbery, that I almost canceled our first one-on-one coffee because I didn't want to miss abs and back day at boot camp. It was April 2015, and Bernie's press secretary, Michael Briggs, had reached out to see if I wanted to sit down with the Vermont senator at a Starbucks near Times Square. I'd said yes before I got word that Hillary would announce her candidacy in the next couple of days. Terrified that I would put on the campaign trail 20 again, and knowing that my mornings would soon turn into sciatica and gut days at a Holiday Inn Express somewhere, I wished I hadn't said yes. I dragged myself to the Starbucks inside the Sheridan on 7th Avenue with the same mix of guilt and obligation as when my mom made me visit her emphysemic Aunt Shirley. Shirley smoked her whole life and spent her golden years in a house dress hooked up to oxygen in a garden home at the Golden Manor Jewish Home for the Aged. We didn't have to bring a kugel to Bernie, but I did have to nod politely as he went through his talking points. I wrote in my notebook, 99%, new income in U.S.